Welcome back to the Unknown Soldiers Podcast. It is I, James Hauser, your host, finally back after a six-month hiatus and ready to take you back on campaign. In a couple weeks, we're going to be kicking off our next series on the Soviet-Afghan War. This is our first series to focus on modern warfare. We're going to be spending the next few months in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. But first, we need to lay some groundwork for this conflict. I have a bad habit, or a good habit, your choice, of putting way too much context into my episodes before I even get to the actual historical events. And I was working on part one of the Soviet-Afghan War series when I realized I'd written way too much context about Afghanistan. But then I thought about multiple fans and listeners who have told me how much they like all the context I do. So I figured, why not let you guys choose how much you want to know about Afghanistan before we kick off the Soviet-Afghan War series? So in the course of the main Soviet-Afghan War Part 1 episode, I am going to give brief context on Afghanistan. This prologue, on the other hand, which you're listening to right now, is the expanded edition of that context. I'll be going into much more detail on Afghanistan's places, people, and its history before the Soviet invasion of 1979. That's also why I'm releasing it ahead of the main episode. So if you listen to both, I'm going to repeat myself a little bit, but only the things that are important. Of course, it's all important, and I mean it. Pretty much every place, every Afghan ethnic group, every religious nuance and geographic feature I mention is going to come back at some point in the series. This is not pointless context, this is relevant context. So what we're going to do here is, first, talk about the people of Afghanistan, their ethnic and religious composition, and their ways of life. Second, we'll be talking about the early history of Afghanistan before the Soviet-Afghan War's events begin, including lots of themes and historical patterns that will reemerge in the rest of the series. And finally, we're going to go on a brief tour of Afghanistan, looking at the major cities and regions. Just we're going to go on like a big loop. Here's this city, here's this city, here's this region, here's an interesting place here, here's a cool thing here. And all of it, again, all of it's going to come back. So without further ado, welcome to Afghanistan. As always, this podcast is not just history, but military history. There's some dark and bloody stuff going on. Podcast is PG-13, language is clean, content is not. All my sources and some custom-made maps just for you will be all over social media, including my website, unknownsoldierspodcast.com. Finally, any errors, mispronunciations, or mistakes are my own. Everything I'm telling you is accurate to the best of my knowledge. This is a real country with real people who don't deserve to be unknown soldiers. The country that we now know as Afghanistan is a very new creation. Like, yeah, it's always been there, but not as Afghanistan. The lands that make up the modern Afghan state were not historically united or seen as a single country until the 19th century. These lands had a whole bunch of names. Bactria, Arakosia, Khorasan, Sistan, Zabulistan, Zamindawar. But they were not called Afghanistan. The lands are old, the cities are old, the ways of life are old. Afghanistan is new. Modern Afghanistan covers about 250,000 square miles. This is a country roughly the size of Texas, and it is a country with amazingly diverse terrain. Deserts in the south in Baluchistan, marshy lowlands in the southwest around Zaranj, wide open steppe lands in the north and west. The northeast is downright Canadian, with giant snow-covered mountains and massive coniferous forests. Fertile farming lands are few and far between, but they can be surprisingly lush. The Soviets would call these areas the Green Zone, the lowland areas that are cultivated and irrigated, so there's a huge amount of greenery in these parts of Afghanistan. There's a lot more green in Afghanistan than you would expect, but only in small areas. But most of all, Afghanistan is a mountain country. Huge, snow-capped mountains oversee the whole land, with jagged gorges and valleys between them. The dramatic slopes and vistas of Afghanistan's mountains have amazed visitors since ancient times. Every U.S. Army veteran from Afghanistan or a Marine veteran I've talked to has mentioned, my deployment sucked, but it is a beautiful country, just how gorgeous and breathtaking these mountains are. Afghanistan has one of the highest average elevations of any country in the world. Two-thirds of the country is 5,000 feet above sea level, which, for contrast, is higher than the tallest mountain in West Virginia, so the average in Afghanistan is higher than anything in West Virginia. The Pamir Mountains in Afghanistan's far northeast are some of the highest mountains in the world. They're like the central mountain hub that connect the Himalayas, the Tian Shan, and the Hindu Kush, stretching across Tajikistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. The Pamir Knot is often referred to as the roof of the world, and multiple ranges extend from it like fingers stretching out from the knot across Afghanistan. The two most important are the massive Hindu Kush through the middle of the country and the Suleiman Range along the Afghan-Pakistani border. The mountain ranges have defined and shaped Afghanistan like the rivers of destiny define the countries of South America, which I talked about back in the Paraguayan War. The biomes in Afghanistan are as much vertical as they are spatial. You can have vastly different ecosystems within a few miles of each other just based on the elevation. The Mughal Emperor Babur described the Kabul Valley as one of his favorite places in the world for just this very reason.
The most pleasing climate in the world. Within a day's ride, it is possible to reach a place where the snow never falls, but within 2 hours, one can go where the snows never melt.
This variance in ecosystems has been very useful for Afghanistan's nomads, who have been able to chase the good weather seasonally as they move between the uplands and the lowlands. The mountains are cut by numerous rivers, forming dramatic valleys and gorges. Every small river going into the mountains has a whole spiderweb of tributaries stretching into the interior, valleys feeding into valleys. Some of these areas, what people in the American South would call the haulers, are among the most remote, isolated places in Asia. Like, there's a valley branching off the valley, going way up into the mountains where nobody's been in, like, decades. The snowfall feeds the rivers that the Afghans use to grow their crops. A poor snowfall can mean a hungry year. The mountain passes of Afghanistan are famous. These mountains are so huge that each pass is a piece of critical terrain. The Khyber Pass from the Kabul Valley down to Peshawar in India is the most famous, but there's also the Bolan Pass from Kandahar to India farther south. The Hindu Kush is broken by 12 mountain passes, including the High Salang Pass, but these passes are closed 6 months out of the year due to snow. In those months, you have to go around the Hindu Kush by way of Herat to Kandahar to Kabul. There are lowlands in Afghanistan, but not many, and lots of them are pretty dry and desolate. Afghanistan has very good little natural farmland, only in a few areas. In the north, near the Amu Darya River in what was once called Bactria. In the west, around the Harirud River near Herat. In the south along the Helmand River, and in the east along the Kabul Valley. Water is scarce in Afghanistan. Afghan farmers do a lot of irrigation to bring the snowmelt and rivers into their croplands, with artificial water courses called juis and man-made underground canals called karezes bringing that water down from the mountains into the lowlands. These tunnels, the underground channels, would be very useful for the Afghan resistance when the Soviets came. Afghan summers are hot and dry, winters are harsh and snowy, the country has been historically prone to famine and poverty. Subsistence farming here is really hard, and if you do it wrong, people are gonna die. It's a hard country, difficult to survive, and the people who live here have to be hard as well. In the 1970s, there were probably about 17 million people living in Afghanistan. Modern Afghanistan may have as many as 40 million. Its population pyramid is insane, like half the country's under the age of 18. 17 million is a rough estimate. Afghan government censuses were notoriously unreliable, so 17 million is probably an undercount for the 1970s. And the first thing to know about Afghanistan, its people, is that national identity means very little here. Ethnic, local, religious, tribal identities are far more important than the Afghan state. The second thing is that this is a highly rural society. Full on, 90% of Afghans were rural in the 1970s, almost all of them living as subsistence farmers or pastoral nomads. The cities make up a small proportion of Afghanistan's population. One thing I cannot stress enough, the cities are not Afghanistan. The countryside is Afghanistan. This is a mistake that the British, the Soviets, the Americans, even many Afghan governments have made. If you're trying to judge popular opinion based on what the cities think, you're wrong. The countryside is where most people live. Controlling the cities is not the same as controlling Afghanistan. You think it is, but it isn't. That's going to be important. About 80% of Afghans live in small villages scattered across the countryside, and this is a hard and toilsome life of subsistence farming. Grain is the main food crop, wheat or barley or rice, but fruits and vegetables and wine grapes are also common. Another 10% of Afghans are pastoral nomads, living much like the Mongols or the Huns or any other people of the old Asian steppe. The dramatic differences in lifestyle and climate mean that Afghans live in a variety of houses, from stone dwellings in the mountains and clay houses in the lowlands and nomadic yurts along the migration routes. A Soviet observer during the Soviet-Afghan War described the fertile areas of the Afghan countryside.
A flowering, fertile plain where settlements built of golden mud bricks spread out among the gardens and vineyards, where cool water filled the handmade wells, where the young rice showed green in tiny, carefully cultivated fields, where flowering poppy and yellow sunflower flamed and burned.
Much of the agriculture and the irrigation systems would be destroyed in the course of the Soviet-Afghan War. The Afghan countryside is decentralized and localized. The local village or valley or tribal area is essentially self-governing and self-sufficient, run by the local khans or the tribal chiefs or the religious mullahs. There are very few class distinctions at the village level. Sure, there are richer and poorer villagers, but Afghan society is remarkably egalitarian and small-d democratic. Villages select their chiefs and religious leaders by consensus, and they can be removed the same way. Of course, over the centuries, certain families or certain clans became established as the local leadership. But there has historically been very little presence from provincial or central governments at the local level. Most, you know, your average Afghan village has no services, no police department, no post office, no tax collectors. Education is for the cities. 90% of Afghans in the 1970s were illiterate. They did not like outsiders and felt like they got along just fine by themselves. Afghans have resented any attempt to control them from the outside, whether it's a foreign invader or their own government. Afghanistan's people are divided into 20 significant ethnic groups, 50 in all. They speak 30 different languages or language groups, though two languages are predominant: Pashto or Pushtu, the Pashtun language, and Dari, a dialect of Persian. Ethnicity and tribe are, again, socially far more important than politics or ideology or even religion. As one Pashtun politician in Pakistan said,
"I have been a Pakistani citizen for 30 years, a Muslim for 1,400 years, and a Pashtun for 5,000 years."
So you see which one he thinks is the most important. We're going to review some of Afghanistan's major ethnicities real quick. Again, all of this will be important. These ethnicities are distinguished by genealogy, language, religion, and whether they're tribal or non-tribal. And keep in mind, most of these ethnicities are divided amongst themselves by tribe or class or bloodline. Most of these groups are famously fractious and divided, especially the Pashtuns. The Pashtuns, often pronounced the Pushtuns, are the dominant ethnic group in Afghanistan, numbering about 40% of the population. So, not a majority, but a plurality. The Pashtuns were the original founders of the Afghan state, and the term Afghan has historically been synonymous with Pashtun. They were possibly mentioned in the ancient Indian Vedas as the Pakhtwa, or in Herodotus' histories as the Pakhtwes. The British tended to call them the Pathans or the Patans. The Pashtuns are Sunni Muslim Pashto speakers living mostly in the south and east of Afghanistan, with large communities in the north. An even larger number live across the border in Pakistan, which we will get to. Most of them are very rural, with only one big majority Pashtun city at Kandahar. The Pashtuns are a tribal people for the most part, with endless divisions and subdivisions based on their genealogy and lineage, real or invented. Get this. The Pashtuns claim to be descended from a common ancestor called Qais. Each of his children is regarded as the common ancestor of the four largest Pashtun groups. The Durranis descended from Qais's first son in south and southwest Afghanistan. The Gilzais descended from Qais's second son in east and southeast Afghanistan, the Gurgusht from Qais's third son in the Kunar Valley and the Balochistan, and the Karlanri from Qais's adopted son, most of whom now live in Pakistan. Ancestry.com would crash if it tried to calculate all the wild ancestral claims each Pashtun group makes. This will be important later. It's all important. The Durranis and the Gilzais are the two largest groups. They've been struggling for power over Afghanistan since the 1700s. So Pashtun culture is based on an almost Highland clan-like loyalty to members of the familial or tribal group, but also a proud and aggressive individualism. The Pashtuns live by a tradition known as the Pashtun Wali, a code of honor and behavior regarding standards of hospitality, independence, forgiveness, justice, and vengeance. Winston Churchill met many Afghans in the 1890s as a young war correspondent, and he described his observations of the Pashtun Wali.
Their system of ethics, which regards treachery and violence as virtues rather than vices, has produced a code of honor so strange and inconsistent that it is incomprehensible to a logical mind.
At its best, Pashtun Wali can mean incredible generosity and forgiveness and unity. At its worst, it means blood feuds and cycles of vengeance and honor killings and toxic masculinity. There is also a tradition of the Jirga, the tribal assembly, where Pashtuns come together and make big political decisions. Like I said, a semi-democratic kind of ideal. Afghanistan's second largest ethnicity are the Tajiks, who are about 30% of the population. The Tajiks are Sunni Muslims who mostly speak Dari. Unlike the Pashtuns, they are not a tribal people. They just identify by their local communities. So I'm a Kohistani Tajik, or a Panjshiri Tajik, or a Mazari Tajik. Like, there's none of this lineage genealogy stuff to the same degree. They consider themselves part of a local community. Historically, the Tajiks are very middle class. Most of Afghanistan's bureaucrats and merchants and urban residents, they were the educated classes. Their knowledge of the Persian language made them ideally suited for the government bureaucracy. Persian was the language of state and high society in most of Central Asia and India up to the modern period. Kabul is a historically Tajik city, though lots of them also live in the north and northeastern countryside. More Tajiks live in Afghanistan than in Tajikistan. The Uzbeks and the much smaller Turkmen are Sunni Muslims who speak Turkish languages like Uzbek or Turkoman, and they live in the north, close to their cousins in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. The Uzbeks and Turkmen arrived in Afghanistan as nomadic conquerors, so they're a pretty tribal people. The Uzbeks settled and became mostly farmers, while the Turkmen remained mostly nomads. Turkmen shepherds produced the famous carpets and sheepskins that Afghanistan is still known for to this day. When the Soviet Union was established in the 1920s, thousands of Uzbeks, Turkmen, and Tajiks fled communism to join their cousins in Afghanistan. So like this big migration in the 1920s and 30s of all these Central Asian tribal and Central Asian peoples fleeing communism to come live in Afghanistan. And as a result, these communities really don't like communism. The Uzbeks and Turkmen together make up about 10% of Afghanistan's population, so combined with the 30% Tajiks, the northern tribes together are about match the Pashtuns in population. The Hazaras are the odd man out. They are a tribal people speaking a dialect of Persian, but unlike the other big groups, they are Shia Muslim, not Sunni. Their homeland is in central Afghanistan, the high isolated massif of the Hindu Kush, an area known as Hazara Jat. The Hazaras are said to descend from the invading Mongol armies of Genghis Khan, hence the name Hazar, meaning thousand, for the thousand-man hordes of the Mongol army. The Hazaras make up a large proportion of the underclasses in many cities. They were a third of Kabul's population in the 1970s. They get persecuted a lot. Everyone hates them. They are the red-headed stepchild of Afghanistan's ethnicities. Nobody likes these guys, especially not the Pashtuns who have persecuted them for centuries. Then there are a bunch of smaller groups, even smaller groups. The Aimak, 4% of the population, a pastoral people in west central Afghanistan. Sunni Muslims, probably of Turkish descent, who organize themselves into four tribes. I'm not going into the four tribes, don't worry. Then you have the Kizilbash, a Persian-speaking Shia group who live mostly in the cities and have a long history in government and trade. The Baluch and the Barukai, the pastoral nomads in the southern deserts, who speak their own language, Baluchi, and are part of much larger groups in Iran and Pakistan. the Pamiris in the Pamir Mountains of the far northeast, who define themselves by each valley and follow an offshoot of Shia Islam called Ismailism. And then there are the Jugis and the Jats and the Kyrgyz and a few pockets of Arabs and Sikhs and Hindus. And there's a bunch of tiny groups that are statistically insignificant, but you get how crazy this is. My favorite weird little Afghan group are the Nuristanis, a tribal people in the extremely isolated northeast around the Alangar, Pech, and Kunar valleys, a region known as Nuristan. These guys are remote, the backwoods of the backwoods. The Nuristanis are strangely light-skinned, sometimes blue-eyed with blonde or red hair, because they are supposedly descended from the Greek settlers of Alexander the Great's time. So you have this possible, it's disputed, but possibly Greek ethnic group living in the mountains of Afghanistan. The Nuristanis speak seven languages that have no relationship to any other language in the area. There's one language spoken only by 5,000 people in a single valley. Duolingo is useless out here. Until the 1890s, the Nuristanis still practiced an ancient animist religion related to Hinduism, and their land was known as Kafiristan, land of the Kafirs, which translates as infidels or pagans. After they were conquered and forced to convert in 1895, their name became Nuristan, Land of Light. Some Nuristanis who did move to Kabul made up a disproportionate part of the government and military personnel, despite their small numbers. So those are Afghanistan's ethnic groups. The Pashtuns, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Turkmen, the Hazaras, the Aymak, etc., 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 etc. What really doesn't help is that geographically, there's not like a clear dividing line between lots of these ethnicities. It's like a patchwork. Some Tajiks over here, some Pashtuns over there. Lots of times they are all intermixed within each other. They have their own districts in most of the cities. And each group is heavily divided within itself. All the Pashtun tribes hate each other, for instance. But take the Nuristanis. Each separate valley in Nuristan regards the other neighboring valley as a bunch of outsiders. And even within the valleys, the lower end of the valley regard the upper end as a bunch of backwards rednecks. People at the upper end regard the lower valley as a bunch of lazy fancy pants putting on airs. An outsider could not tell the difference between the two groups for the life of them, but they can tell you. Oh, that guy's a low valley guy. We don't like those people. I didn't really understand this visceral hatred for the guy one town over until I moved to Wisconsin and heard how they talk about people from Illinois. There's a saying in Afghanistan.
Me against my brothers. My brothers and me against our cousins. My brothers' cousins and me against the world.
The Afghans even have a word for these struggles. Tarbarwali, the War of Cousins, where old family and blood feuds can last for generations, where the person closest to you is likeliest to be your deadliest enemy. This is why I say there's always someone gunning for you when you're on top in Afghanistan. This is a highly fractured, independent-minded society where alliances shift quickly, grudges last for centuries, and you can never be secure because there's always a rival out there somewhere for you. The upshot is, these people do not consider themselves part of a single nation, and never have. I describe it as five or six nations stuffed inside a single country-sized onesie. If you ask an American, a Frenchman, a Chinese person what they are, they'll probably say American, or French, or Chinese. But if you ask someone from Afghanistan, they'll say, I'm a Pashtun, I'm a Tajik, I'm a Nuristani, before they tell you what Pashtun tribe, or Tajik region, or Nuristani valley they belong to. There is only one thing that is common to all Afghans, one thing that stands a chance of uniting Afghanistan, and that is Islam. Islam is so ingrained in Afghan society that there is basically no difference between the two. Islam is Afghan society. It permeates every aspect of life. It is deeply integrated, interwoven. Islam is present at births and funerals and marriages and business transactions, down to the most basic conversations and interactions. For those of you who grew up religious but aren't anymore or didn't grow up religious at all, this might seem very strange, stifling, even backwards and barbaric, but it's literally so ingrained that Afghans don't notice it. It's just life. It's like asking a fish if it notices the water. European Christianity used to be like this in the Middle Ages, this all-encompassing worldview and foundation of society. One of the big historical trends over the last several centuries is the decline of religion as the primary force in Western culture, to the point that we can forget very easily how fundamental it used to be. The vast majority of Afghans, around 85%, are Sunni. The other 15% are Shia, almost all of them Hazaras or Kizilbash. Religious distinctions are usually based on ethnicity rather than individual conscience. If you're a Pashtun, you're a Sunni. You don't really get an option. There are very small minorities of other religions, tiny Hindu and Sikh communities in Kabul, a Zoroastrian community of about 10,000 people still hanging on in northern Afghanistan. Wild, right? The Zoroastrians still exist. And there were a couple of Jews still living in Kabul until they fled in 2021 for Taliban reasons. Many Sunnis are part of a Sufi order, a mystical background with deep roots in Persian Islamic tradition. Sufi orders gather around a grand master, often a hereditary title held by one family. Their worship and traditions are much more mystical and spiritual than mainstream Islam. Lots of instrumental music, dancing, singing, meditation, and incense burning. One of the more famous Sufi practices is the Sufi whirling, spinning around rapidly as a form of trance or meditation, which has led Westerners to call them the whirling dervishes. Islamic Sufism, I think I mentioned last year, had a heavy influence on the founding of Sikhism. The two big Sufi sects in Afghanistan are the Naqshbandi and the Qadiriyya, both of which are very strong in Pashtun tribal areas and around Herat. The eastern branch of the Naqshbandiya are traditionally led by the Mujahideen family, descendants of the order's greatest disciple, Sheikh Ahmad Sirhindi, while the Qadiriyya are traditionally led by the Gailani family, though not all Afghan Sufis follow either of these families. The Sufi orders played a large role in the Anglo-Afghan wars when they rallied their followers against the invader, and they would play a large role again in the war against the Soviets. Local religious leaders, the mullah, and the high clergy, the ulema, are part of the fabric of Afghan society. They are the ones that bring their communities together, settle disputes, mediate conflicts, oversee transactions, perform birthrights and funerals and marriages and calls to prayer. They also rally the community to help the needy, punish the wicked, or unite against an outside threat. The clerics govern by Sharia law, which is a scary word to many Westerners but is essential for Afghan society. It basically provides a criminal code and arbitration mechanism for settling those tribal blood feuds. Like, Sharia law is a much more comprehensive and rigid set of laws that supersedes tribal law in many cases, and tribal law can often be much more violent than Sharia law. Many a mullah wielding Sharia law as his authority has stopped two valleys from going to war. When he asks two disputing parties to make peace in the name of Allah, you can't really argue with that. Afghans practice a traditional local form of Islam that many foreign Muslims see as heretical or impure. Lots of old pre-Islamic traditions have survived into the modern day. Many mullahs still provide cures and potions, perform exorcisms, or even practice magical rites that foreign Muslims would regard as haram or sinful. But the Afghans not only reject those judgments, they consider their version of Islam to be purer and better than any other version. There's some circular logic here, because Afghans know they are the best Muslims. Anything they do is what the best Muslims do. The place of women in Afghan society I will discuss much more comprehensively down the road. It is often caught between local tradition and Islamic law, both of which can be weirdly restrictive or weirdly liberating depending on where you are. Local traditions in northern Afghanistan are much more permissive towards women's independence and rights than in, say, southern Afghanistan. Most women in the countryside do not walk around fully veiled or concealed. They gotta do farm work, that's just not practical. They are subject to a strict patriarchal society, forced marriage, etc. But I will say that before the Soviet-Afghan War, Afghan women didn't have it much worse than women in other traditional societies worldwide. The modern day, we see Afghanistan as this horrible place for women. The bar wasn't high, but it wasn't, you know, the worst place in the world for women, basically until the Taliban came around. The Taliban's views on women, like their interpretation of Islam in general, is far more radical than the traditional Afghan view. I am going to do a Women of the Afghan War short round near the end of this series. That's one of the things I plan to do. I'm going to talk extensively about the experience of women in the Soviet-Afghan War, and it's going to be freaking bleak, guys. It's going to be super depressing. No girl power here. Another thing I have to hammer home is the importance of Islam in political legitimacy. Since Islam is so interwoven into Afghan society, there isn't a lot of separation of church and state. Afghanistan is Islamic. Any un-Islamic or non-Islamic government is bound to produce social unrest or outright rejection. Afghans will not accept a non-Islamic government as legitimate. How can you rule this most Muslim of countries if you aren't a good Muslim yourself? Even when the United States helped Afghanistan set up a government in 2001-2002, it was explicitly an Islamic republic, not just the liberal secular democracy of Afghanistan, because that was a dead letter from the beginning. So that is Afghanistan, its geography and its people. The big upshots: Afghanistan is a highly decentralized country where family, local, tribal concerns matter much more than national concerns. Afghans are strongly devoted to freedom and independence, sharply divided along ethnic and regional lines. It has only been unified under two circumstances: an unusually strong leader or a threat from the outside, especially a threat to Islam itself. Yes, this is foreshadowing. It's all foreshadowing. For all these reasons, the central government in Afghanistan has historically been very weak. Governments have controlled the major cities, but their control over the countryside, the rural areas, has always been extremely loose. Rural Afghans acknowledge government authority in theory, especially if the ruler is a good Muslim, but actually trying to govern them always produces a backlash. They don't want you telling them what to do. Afghanistan functions on a very simple social contract. You don't bother us, we don't bother you. You guys stay in your cities and do whatever you want, be as weird and liberal and non-traditional as you want, but you come up here into the mountains and try to tell us what to do, we're gonna have a problem. So smart Afghan rulers have never tried to exert direct control over the whole country, especially the countryside. Even if you succeed, the countryside is poor, barely worth the time and effort you spent to conquer it. But if you fail, now you've pissed off the mountain tribes and they're gonna freaking kill you. This is the lesson the British learned in the First Anglo-Afghan War, resulting in a long line of dead bodies on the snowy road from Kabul. So if Afghanistan is five or six countries in a country-sized onesie, how did it become a thing? Well, Afghans only unite under one of two circumstances: an unusually strong leader or a threat from the outside, especially a threat to Islam. And those were the circumstances in which the modern Afghanistan came to be. Part 2, the history. Despite just wanting to be left alone, geography placed Afghanistan at the crossroads of history. For millennia, the mountain passes were the central transit point between Central Asia, China, India, and Persia. The Khyber Pass from Kabul to India, the Bolan Pass from Kandahar to India, were the highways for armies and explorers and merchants and migrants and missionaries and pilgrims. Buddhism went up these passes into China. Islam came down these passes into India. The Silk Road passed through the great trade cities, with all the riches of China and Persia and Central Asia and Europe flowing back and forth. The notion that Afghanistan has never been conquered, is unconquerable, is downright untrue. Afghanistan has been ruled by outsiders for most of its history. The Persians ruled Afghanistan. They called them the provinces of Arakossia, Bactria, and Gandhara. Alexander the Great swept through, fighting the tribes in the Kunar Valley on his way into India. And a few decades later, the Mauryan emperors of India conquered Afghanistan from their side. Waves of nomadic conquerors from the Central Asian steppes, the Kushans and the Huns and the Turks, swept through over the centuries. The Arabs came through on their conquests. But the only things worth controlling in Afghanistan were the trade routes. So these conquerors, all of them, just took the major cities and paid off the tribes to guard the trade routes. Those were the important bits. They left everything else alone. The one exception was Genghis Khan, the red-eyed genocide demon of the Middle Ages, who basically just slaughtered his way across everything, including Afghanistan. He was the only one to really go out of his way to mess up people in the countryside, and he was Genghis Khan, so he just killed them all and moved on, because he didn't really stick around. And he was the exception. For everyone else, the key to controlling and ruling Afghanistan was take the cities, take the major trade routes, rule with a light touch, and leave the tribes and the mountain people alone. And for most of history, the lands of modern Afghanistan were usually attached to one empire or another. Herat and western Afghanistan were historically part of Persia. Northern Afghanistan was historically part of Central Asia. Kandahar and Kabul were a border region ruled from India or Persia or Central Asia. During the 1500s-1600s, Kandahar and Kabul were the border region between the Persian Safavid Empire and the Indian Mughal Empire. Persia usually controlled Herat, and the Mughals usually controlled Kabul, and Kandahar would change hands every decade or so because they were always fighting each other for it. So Afghanistan was almost always ruled by outsiders. There are all these empires. It's not the graveyard of empires in this time period. It's all these empires that pass over Afghanistan and control the roads and the major cities and leave everyone else alone, and everyone's fine with that. But in the 1700s, the Safavid and Mughal empires both went into simultaneous decline, opening up a power vacuum between them on what was once their border region. Afghanistan was born in this power vacuum, unified, like I said, under an unusually strong leader. Ahmad Shah Abdali was the founder of the Afghan state. He was a Pashtun, a former general in the Persian army. After his former boss, Nadir Shah, was assassinated, Ahmad Shah seized the Persian royal treasury and made his way home. He attended Aloya Jirga, a Pashtun tribal council, in the city of Kandahar, where, according to Pashtun legend, they acclaimed him as the new king, the new Shah of Afghanistan. Abdali took the new name, Dur-e-Duran, Pearl of Pearls, and his tribe changed their names from Abdali to Durrani. The Durrani tribe would rule Afghanistan in one form or another from 1747 until 1978. The fall of the Durranis is one of the opening events of the Soviet-Afghan War. It's important that Afghanistan as a state was originally founded as a specifically Pashtun kingdom. Ever since then, the Pashtuns have taken their supremacy within Afghanistan for granted. Like, Afghanistan is a Pashtun country, even though they're only 40% of the population. And it's also important that Afghanistan was ruled by Ahmad Shah's tribe, the Durranis. Their historical rivals, the Gilzai Pashtuns in southeastern Afghanistan, have resented Durrani rule ever since. One of Ahmad Shah's first problems as king was subduing the Gilzais, and he would not be the last Durrani king to have to do that. The original Durrani Empire conquered a vast stretch of territory, far beyond current Afghanistan, from Iran and Central Asia to most of northern and western India, including the Punjab. Ahmad Shah captured Delhi a couple times. When I talked about the Sikhs fighting the Afghans back in episode 54, Glory of the Khalsa, these are the Afghans they were fighting, the Durrani Empire. But then, in 1772, Ahmad Shah died, and his sons all started killing each other, and the empire began to dissolve. Bloody power struggles at the top are a constant theme in Afghan history. Remember, me against my brother, me and my brother against my cousins. It's so common that they have a term for it. It's called Badshahgardi, or ruler turning, aka meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Just the kings and the princes and the royal family just murdering each other, and everybody else in Afghanistan is like, oh, just some more Badshahgardi. Not gonna change my life. Go on with my day. And as a result of all this Badshahgardi, the Durrani Empire collapsed. Other powers swooped in to exploit the chaos. The Persians in the west, the Russians in the north, and especially in the east, the Sikhs. The Sikh ruler Ranjit Singh drove the Durranis from most of their Indian territories, and in 1823 he conquered the city of Peshawar. Peshawar is a historically Pashtun city, Kabul's opposite number, the other terminus of the Khyber Pass. The Pashtuns have never gotten over the loss of Peshawar. It's currently in Pakistan today, and the city will play a major role in the Soviet-Afghan War. By the mid-19th century, the Durrani kingdom was reduced to the core territories of modern Afghanistan. So, like, they had this huge empire, it gets chipped away, it shrinks, what's left is modern-day Afghanistan. It was around this point that the British tried and failed twice to conquer Afghanistan. I do not need to go over this again. I do not need to go over the First and Second Anglo-Afghan Wars again. Those are Unknown Soldiers Podcast episodes 1 and 34. But I do need to go over some important consequences. The Anglo-Afghan Wars forced Afghanistan to evolve. From the wreckage of the Durrani Empire emerged a Kingdom of Afghanistan, smaller, poorer, weaker, but much more cohesive and stable with roughly its current borders. This kingdom had a stronger and more centralized state based in Kabul, with a bureaucracy and a standing army created in order to resist foreign dominance. Like, this is the end result of the British invasions of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has to centralize and unite, at least politically, to stop the foreign invasions. And in both wars, the British faced greater resistance not from the Afghan kingdom's standing army, but from the tribes and the rural militias. The British would capture the cities, but as we've seen, controlling the cities isn't controlling Afghanistan. The rural population would be led by their traditional tribal chiefs and mullahs, who rallied the people to fight the foreigner and the infidel. The Naqshbandi and the other Sufi groups would rally their followers to resist the foreign invader. In both wars, it was tribal resistance, not the resistance of the Afghan state, that made it impossible for the British to hold Afghanistan. But the power of the countryside was just as dangerous to the Durrani leaders in Kabul as it was to the British. Lots of the resistance to the British came from the Gilzai Pashtuns, the historical enemies of the Durrani dynasty, and from the independent-minded Sufi sects. So after each Anglo-Afghan war, the Afghan rulers have to run around playing whack-a-mole, you know, reasserting their dominance over these tribes. Okay, yeah, we beat the British, now get back in your place. See, this kind of local tribal resistance might be effective at defeating an invader, but it inherently decentralizes and fragments political power across the country. The resistance of the Afghan tribes to foreign rule is like an immune system disorder, where the antibodies attack the diseases, but then they start attacking healthy cells. In the process of making the country ungovernable for foreigners, they can also make the country ungovernable for Afghans. And I've basically given you the answers to the test to what happens to Afghanistan after the Soviets invade. They made it ungovernable for the Soviets, they also made it ungovernable for themselves. This is a pattern that will be repeated in the Soviet-Afghan War. Finally, the British invasions reinforced Afghan paranoia, xenophobia, and fear of foreign domination. They were a small, landlocked, remote country surrounded by bigger and stronger empires. Future Afghan rulers knew they would have to play the empires off against each other to preserve Afghanistan's independence. Again, there are two things that have ever unified Afghanistan: a threat from the outside, like the British Empire, or an unusually strong ruler. And from 1880 to 1901, Afghanistan had an unusually strong ruler, Abdurrahman Khan. You may remember him from episode 34, you probably don't. This was the Second Anglo-Afghan War, ended with him making a deal with the British to take the throne. This deal was that Abdurrahman would maintain Afghanistan as a strong British-allied buffer state against the Russians, and the British would control Afghanistan's foreign relations with other powers. In exchange, the British would give the Afghans enormous subsidies and lots of weapons for the Durrani kings to maintain their power. Abdurrahman was very good at balancing the British against the Russians. In the meantime, he used those British subsidies and British weapons to assert his dominance inside Afghanistan. Abdurrahman Khan was probably the strongest, most ruthless leader in Afghan history. He crushed anyone who challenged him, the tribes, the religious leaders, the Sufi sects, and especially the Gilzai Pashtuns. He was honestly kind of evil. Abdurrahman solidified his authority by portraying himself as the defender of Sunni Islam against the infidel foreigners, British and Russian, and the infidels inside Afghanistan. He declared a jihad against the minority Shia Hazaras, resulting in something that is called the Hazara genocide, where about 60% of the Hazara population was killed or enslaved. That's how a bunch of Hazaras ended up in Kabul. They were originally brought there as slaves. Abdurrahman also converted the polytheists up in Nuristan to Islam at the point of a sword in 1895. On top of all this, Abdurrahman created the modern Afghan state. He concentrated all political authority in Kabul, draining power from the provinces and giving the central government the final say on national politics. So Afghanistan only centralizes on the capital politically under Abdurrahman's reign. Abdurrahman reinforced Afghanistan's Islamic identity, its hatred and xenophobia towards foreigners, and the supremacy of the Pashtun ethnicity over all others. This was a reign of terror. The most well-known tyrant I could compare him to might be Stalin, but for me, he most resembles someone like Ivan the Terrible, or a worse version of Oliver Cromwell. Afghanistan was peaceful, safe, and unified, mainly through fear. Abdurrahman created the modern Afghan state. Afghan history remembers him as the Iron Amir, or Iron King. He is not regarded fondly, but with awe and dread, almost like a force of nature who did unify their country, but killed a lot of people. His reward was to die of natural causes in 1901, which doesn't sound like much, until I tell you that every single ruler of Afghanistan since Abdurrahman Khan has been assassinated, murdered, or overthrown, which does not bode well for the 20th century. On his deathbed, Abdurrahman told his son Habibullah,
"My last words to you, my son and successor, are never trust the Russians."
Which is great advice. Shame that future Afghan leaders didn't listen. It was during Abdurrahman's reign that Afghanistan's borders were defined. Horrible borders that were horribly drawn and would ruin everything. Who do we think drew these horrible borders? You get three guesses. And you're right, it's the British. If there's ever a janky border that has caused decades of ethnic conflict, there's a better than even chance that it was drawn by some monocle-wearing English moron named something like Lord Pumpernickel Haverforth V. The borders that the British drew up for Afghanistan were so god-awful that they have caused problems for every government on either side of them ever since. Afghanistan's northern border was drawn in an agreement between the British and the Russians along the Amu Darya River. So that leaves Uzbeks and Tajiks and Turkmen on either side of this border. Like, a river's a good border, right? You know, it makes a little sense. Yeah, but a lot of times rivers are like the center of a civilization, not the edge of it. So you're just drawing a border down the center of the Uzbek and Tajik and Turkmen civilizations. The Afghans didn't like this border. No one asked them. The British and the Russians just said, hey, here's your new border now. But at least it was, you know, a geographic feature, so it made some kind of sense. What made less sense was the Wakhan Corridor. The British and the Russians really didn't want their empires to touch each other. So they forced Abdurrahman to take over the Wakhan Valley, a thin little strip of land stretching into the Pamir Mountains. It's only like 20 miles wide. This is mostly worthless territory, but that's the reason why Afghanistan has this weird little hangnail of territory on its eastern tip, literally a not-touching-you kind of situation. But the worst border by far was the Durand Line. It was drawn by some British douchebag named Mortimer Durand, who looked like if blood pudding came to life. In the 1890s, the British Indian government commissioned him to demarcate the border between British India and the Afghan kingdom. This border was purely defensive. It was a military border. Which mountain gives the best fields of fire? What's the best place for a fort? What's easily connected by a road from the British side? And it took no notice of ethnic or local or political or tribal or sometimes even common sense geography. The result was a border, a national border, that literally split villages down the middle, cut tribes in two, completely screwed up centuries-old nomadic migration routes, and it divided the Pashtun ethnicity in half. That is why there are more Pashtuns in Pakistan today than there are in Afghanistan, the kingdom that the Pashtuns founded. Pashtuns are a permanent minority in both Afghanistan and Pakistan because of this border. This huge chunk of ethnically Pashtun land, along with the Pashtun city of Peshawar, has been described as Afghanistan's phantom limb, its lost province. And no government of Afghanistan, whether the monarchy, the communists, the American-backed democracy, the Taliban, has ever accepted this border as legitimate. This is a century-old grudge, and God knows the Afghans are good at holding grudges. The issue of many Afghan leaders have talked about a Pashtunistan, someday in the future when they're going to retake the lost land and reunite the Pashtuns under Afghanistan, which is like, you know, territorial irredentism, which is, you know, not uncommon in any part of the world. Just look at frickin' Russia and Ukraine. But this is a strong historical force in Afghan politics. You'll still hear Afghans talking about reuniting the Pashtuns. And the population on the ground have also refused to accept this border. Like I said, tribal, regional, ethnic concerns supersede national concerns. People on the ground just ignored the Durand Line, pretended like it wasn't there, carried on as if it didn't exist. So this border was utterly unenforceable, and basically still is. People walk across it giving zero craps every day, not caring about citizenship or passports or customs or nothing. The Durand Line is now the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and this border has been a constant problem for anyone on either side of it. It was an immediate problem for the people who drew it. The Durand Line became the British Empire's legendary northwest frontier, a hostile land full of angry Pashtun tribes that were borderline impossible to subdue. Pretty much as soon as this border is put in place, the Pashtuns are like, nope, we're not accepting this, and they rise up in rebellion. And they are in constant rebellion against the British, basically until they leave India. This included many famous campaigns in British and Indian military lore, including the Battle of Satyagrahi and the 21 Sikhs. As we will see, the border would be a huge problem for the Soviets, and it would be a problem for the Americans when bin Laden escaped across it in 2001, and for everybody, the Soviets and Americans, the resistance, the guerrilla resistance, is constantly receiving supplies and recruits, and people are possibly going back and forth across this border that nobody can control. As of this recording in 2025, the Taliban is doing a bunch of military posturing against Pakistan over the issue of Pashtunistan, over reclaiming the lost provinces. This historical issue, this is an issue right now. All my homies hate the Durand Line. So yeah, thanks a lot, Britain. Afghanistan entered the 20th century as a poor, isolated mountain kingdom sandwiched between empires. But here's something I want you to understand. Right now, really. Most of you will only know Afghanistan as a place of bloodshed and tragedy. Afghanistan in the news is always synonymous with conflict and war and oppression and third world nightmare. And I've heard the cliche over and over that Afghanistan has always been like that. Those people have always been at war. But it hasn't. They haven't. For the majority of the 20th century, Afghanistan was one of the most peaceful countries on earth. From 1901 to 1978, Afghanistan only fought in one external war, the very brief Third Anglo-Afghan War in 1919, and one major internal war, the Civil War of 1929. We're going to go over each of these real quick. The Third Anglo-Afghan War is not getting an Unknown Soldiers podcast episode. Why? Because it lasted for like 4 months and almost nothing happened. Okay, this war was part of the after the armistice period, the chaos and the aftermath of World War I. So in 1919, Afghanistan's King Amanullah, who was Abdurrahman's grandson, decided to rile up the Pashtun tribes and launch an attack on the northwest frontier on the Durand Line. He figured that Britain had just gotten out of World War I, they were dealing with a lot of issues all over their empire after the armistice, so this might mean the opportunity for Afghanistan to retake those lost provinces. So the Afghans attacked, and didn't go well. The British were still pretty frickin' strong, and they chopped the Afghan army up pretty good. The only really notable event of the Third War was when British aircraft bombed Kabul and Jalalabad. These were like biplanes, so they didn't do a whole lot of damage, but this was the first time most Afghans had ever seen aircraft, and there's bombs exploding in their city all of a sudden. You get the feeling that this caused them to rearrange their mental calculus about fighting the British. Oh, the infidels can fly now. That's new. The Third Anglo-Afghan War lasted 4 months, from May to August 1919. And even though the Afghans lost most of what amounted to the battles, they kind of won. The British just didn't have the time to deal with this. They were dealing with like 10 other fires all over their empire. And they just cut a deal, all right? The Afghan government officially recognized the Durand Line as the border fingers crossed behind their back, because they would renounce this a few years later. But the British also gave up any control over Afghan foreign policy. So they were no longer in the British sphere of influence. Many Afghans regard this as their achievement of independence. So King Amanullah was riding pretty high after this victory. But then he got himself into trouble. In the 1920s, Amanullah made a grand tour of the world, one of the first sitting Afghan leaders to leave Afghanistan and go see other parts of the world. So he went to Italy and France and Germany and Britain and Turkey. Then he came back to Afghanistan. He's like, guys, I got a vision. I want to modernize my country and bring it on par with the West. So he launched a series of extremely ambitious reforms, including women's liberation, freedom of the press, increased taxation and census operations and central banking, the abolition of the veil, and he wanted to really de-emphasize the Islamic nature of the country. So he started canceling religious holidays and ordered people to stop wearing traditional Afghan clothing and start wearing Western suits, all sorts of stuff. At first, he confined these reforms to Kabul, and people didn't really care that much. Most of Kabul was like, oh, sure, whatever. But then Amanullah tried to enforce these reforms on the countryside, and people went berserk. He was trying to do way too much, way too fast, and he was trying to tell the tribes and the mountain people how what to do, and they don't like that. Amanullah basically alienated all the ethnicities, all the tribes, all the religious leaders, all at once, and they reacted. A massive uprising in 1928 drove Amanullah from the capital. He was replaced for a few months by a Tajik warlord named Habibullah Kalakani. But if the Pashtun tribes had hated Amanullah for being a woke tard, they really hated having a Tajik as their new king. They called him the Bachai Sakau, the son of the water carrier, for his low lineage. So in October 1929, Nadir Khan, from another branch of the Durrani dynasty, overthrew the Tajik usurper and reinstated Pashtun control over the country. This was the only time that a Tajik leader and not a Pashtun leader had ever tried to govern Afghanistan until 1992, which we will get to. It didn't go well then either. Amanullah's downfall had a bunch of lessons for anyone who was paying attention. Number one, if you want to do modernization in Afghanistan, you gotta slow roll it, especially when it comes to the countryside. Number two, what happens in Kabul and how people react to it is not necessarily reflective of how most Afghans feel. That was Amanullah's big mistake. His reforms went well in the city. He tried to measure the city's public opinion and think that was Afghan public opinion. No, it did not go well in the rural areas. They have different opinions. Three, the Pashtuns regard Afghanistan as their country and will react violently to any other ethnicity trying to govern it. All of this would come back to haunt Afghanistan in the later 20th century. But still, those were the only two major conflicts Afghanistan fought from 1901 to 1978, the Third Anglo-Afghan War, which was small, and the Civil War of 1929, which was brief. That was it. Afghanistan went through the World Wars and the Great Depression and the early Cold War with probably fewer conflicts than any other nation on Earth. Seriously. This is not an inherently violent, inherently savage or warlike country. A lot of that perception is frankly a little bit racist. And it's not your fault if you thought that. That's the image the media portrays of the inherently brutal and violent Afghanistan, but the war-torn Afghanistan we have seen for the last few decades is a new development. And how that happened is the story I'm going to tell in this upcoming series. Because Afghanistan was not a failed state before 1978. The shattering of this country was something that was done to it. Nadir Khan's descendants, this new branch of the Durrani dynasty, ruled Afghanistan until 1978. And for most of this time period, they ruled with a very, very light hand. They had a lot of power in Kabul, but very little in the countryside, and that was fine by everyone. Then the Cold War began. And once again, Afghanistan was caught between two empires. This time, the United States and the Soviet Union. The Afghan king in this period was Zahir Shah Mohammad, but real power was held by his cousin, the Prime Minister Daoud Khan. Daoud Khan was a charismatic leader, a nationalist who wanted a strong, independent, modern Afghanistan. He was something like an autocratic progressive, pushing economic development and modernization to bring Afghanistan into the 20th century, but he wanted it to be him in charge during the whole thing. But he needed military and economic aid to make that happen. Afghanistan is freaking landlocked and has no real resources. And in the Cold War, the best way to get that aid was to align with one of the two superpowers. Daoud's first choice was the United States, but the United States wasn't interested. Afghanistan wasn't important, it was too remote, it had beef with Pakistan, who was an American ally, and if the Soviets did try to intervene in Afghanistan, they would basically be helpless to defend it. So after being rejected by the Americans one last time in 1954, Daoud Khan aligned Afghanistan with the Soviet Union. And the Soviets were pleased as punch to give Afghanistan all the aid it wanted. From their point of view, Afghanistan sat on their southern border. It was a counterbalance to American allies, Iran and Pakistan. And the USSR was looking for Cold War allies. Sure, Afghanistan was very poor, underdeveloped, a conservative religious monarchy. But when it came to Cold War allies, beggars couldn't be choosers. Daoud Khan knew it was a risk to align with the Soviet Union. But he figured that, number one, the Soviets would be idiots to try to invade Afghanistan, and number two, communism would have no real appeal to the Afghan people. Daoud was right on both accounts, as it turned out, but that didn't help. Plus, Pakistan had aligned with the Americans, and if Afghanistan has one foreign policy constant over the last century, it is, Pakistan, give us our land back. The Soviets opened the taps on economic and military assistance. Soviet money flowed in. Soviet experts arrived to oversee engineering projects and reform measures. And Soviet military equipment arrived to re-equip the Afghan army and Soviet military advisors to go with it. Soviet professors began to teach chemistry and engineering at Kabul University. And Soviet economic aid began to transform the country. In 1964, the Soviets finished the 2.6-kilometer-long Salong Tunnel, a highway tunnel under the Salong Pass in the Hindu Kush Mountains. Not only was it the highest highway tunnel in the world at the time, but for the first time, it was possible to cross the Hindu Kush in the winter. Other projects included Great Hardball Highways, a giant loop around the country through the major cities. The Americans also started sending some aid as well in 1957. They were the ones to build the Kabul to Kandahar highway, and they helped to irrigate the Helmand Valley, though they always played second fiddle to the Soviets. The most obvious Soviet aid was to the Afghan military. By the 1970s, the Afghan army fielded Soviet T-55 tanks and MiG-21 jet fighters and Su-7 bombers. Its soldiers carried AK-47s and wore Soviet-style uniforms. Their officer corps were mostly trained in Soviet military academies. And the Soviets built a lot of their new military bases, including giant air bases at Shindand, near Herat, and Bagram, north of Kabul. Bagram, or Bagram, it's pronounced both ways, but Bagram Air Base was a centerpiece of the American occupation of Afghanistan as well. And Afghanistan was opening up to the outside world. The Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev visited in 1955. U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower visited in 1959. Kabul's streets were full of cars, radios blasting from windows, electric lights keeping people up at night. Hippies and tourists traveling Asia in the 1960s found a harmless, peaceful country full of friendly people and cool knickknacks to bring back home to California. The Afghan Tourist Bureau described Kabul in 1965, like, come to Kabul, it's a great place to come on vacation.
Kabul is a fast-growing city where tall, modern buildings nuzzle against bustling bazaars, and wide avenues filled with brilliant flowering turbans, gaily striped chapans, mini-skirted schoolgirls, a multitude of handsome faces, and streams of whizzing traffic.
If you see photographs of Kabul from the 1960s and 1970s, it is a modern-looking city. It's bizarre to see Afghan girls in jeans and sundresses eating ice cream on the streets, Afghan dudes walking around in suits. It looked like a modern city. And people will look at this on Facebook and say, look at what Afghanistan was before XYZ. But one very important thing to remember, the cities are not Afghanistan. Kabul was modernizing, the big urban center was modernizing, transforming, but it was in a weird little modern bubble. And in that bubble, the only place where anything was happening according to the media, it was easy to forget just how little the government controlled right outside the city limits. Out there, the Afghan countryside existed as it always had, subsistence farming and traditional religion and wanting to be left alone. The capital and the countryside had never been more separate, culturally, economically, and socially. But the Afghan rulers still knew better than to push modernization too hard on their very traditional, very independent-minded people. That would change in 1978. King Zahir Shah in the 1960s started to grow uneasy with Daoud's close alignment with the Soviet Union. The breaking point came when Daoud tried to push the Pashtunistan issue with Pakistan. Daoud was a nationalist. He wanted to reunify the Pashtun people inside Afghanistan's borders. But this caused Pakistan to close the border, cutting off trade with Afghanistan, which not only hurt the Afghan economy, but made it even more reliant on the Soviet Union. For Zahir Shah, this was the last straw. On March 9, 1963, Daoud Khan was removed from power, and the king set up a new government. The next 10 years would see the king implement a semi-democratic constitutional monarchy based on the model of the Pashtun Loya Jirga, with a parliament and cabinet offices and public debates and everything. For about 10 years, from 1963 to 73, Afghanistan was a functioning constitutional monarchy. But Daoud did not take kindly to being fired. In the long tradition of Tarbrawali, brother against brother, cousin against cousin, he would have his revenge. And when he did, it would start the tragic chain of events leading to the Soviet-Afghan War. That is where our story really takes off in the Soviet-Afghan War Part 1, in 1973, with Daoud Khan's seizure of power. Part 3, The Tour. Now that we are caught up on our history, to finish off our survey of Afghanistan, we're going to go on a grand tour. A big loop around the country as it was in the 1970s, looking at the major regions and the major cities. After all, Afghanistan is about to not only be one of the sides in this war, it's about to be the battlefield. So if you're hanging out at home or whatnot, maybe pull up a map just to follow along. Or pull up one of the maps I have on my website. Afghanistan is traditionally divided into four major historical regions. We're going to start in the north. The Persians called this region Ariana, the Greeks called it Bactria. This was once one of the richest provinces of the Persian Empire. Its capital was Balkh, which the Persians called Zariaspa and the Greeks called Bactra. Balkh was the mother of cities, birthplace of Zoroaster, one of the great hubs of the Silk Road in the ancient medieval worlds. Marco Polo passed this way in the late 1200s. He described Balkh as a noble city and a great seat of learning. Then Genghis Khan came through and destroyed the city, and Balkh was never the same again. These days, Balkh is in ruins, though people still do live nearby. It's been replaced as the major city in the north by Mazar-i-Sharif, about 12 miles to the southeast of the ruins of Balkh. Mazar is the fifth largest city in Afghanistan, its lowest elevated major city, and it contains the Blue Mosque, allegedly the mausoleum of Ali, son-in-law of Muhammad, and the revered figure of Shia Muslims. The north also contains smaller cities like Kunduz, Gurmak, and Faizabad. The Amu Darya River, known to the ancient Greeks as the Oxus, marks Afghanistan's northern border. In the 1970s, this was the border with the Soviet Union, specifically the Turkmen, Uzbek, and Tajik Soviet Socialist Republics, or SSRs. After the fall of the Soviet Union, these of course became Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. Unsurprisingly, the main ethnic groups in northern Afghanistan are Turkmen, Uzbeks, and Tajiks. Mazar-i-Sharif is a majority Tajik city, with a large Hazara minority. The main languages are Dari, the form of Persian spoken by the Tajiks, and the Turkish languages Uzbek and Turkmen. For all these reasons, northern Afghanistan has much more in common culturally with Central Asia than with the rest of Afghanistan. There is also a significant Pashtun population in northern Afghanistan. Abdurrahman Khan settled many rebellious Gilzai Pashtuns here in the 1880s and 1890s, like part of a program of forced deportation. These guys are troublemakers, why don't we just spread them out over the country a bit? So these guys, the Gilzai Pashtuns of the north, have usually relied on the central government to back them against the Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Turkmen. The economy in the north relies on trade across the Amu Darya. Cotton became a big cash crop around Kunduz in the 20th century, and the Turkmen are famous for producing fine Afghan carpets and sheepskins. Of course, just across the Amu Darya was the Soviet Union. Two railways crossed Soviet territory and ended at the river, at the cities of Serhetabad in the Turkmen SSR and Termez in the Uzbek SSR. These railways would be the USSR's major logistics lines during the Soviet-Afghan War, and these towns would be the logistics hubs keeping the Soviet occupation army supplied. Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan War had no railroads. The railroads stopped at the Amu Darya at the Soviet-Afghan border, and they would be targets for insurgent attack down the road. Moving on. Western Afghanistan borders Iran to the west. It is dominated by the ancient city of Herat. Herat is one of the oldest continually occupied cities in the world. It is very much a historically Persian city. It was known as the Pearl of Khorasan in the ancient medieval periods. In the 1400s, it was the capital of Timur, or Tamerlane, the great Turco-Mongol conqueror, and under his rule it became one of the artistic and intellectual capitals of the late medieval Middle East. There are ruins from the Timurid era all over Herat, including five giant minarets that are probably going to fall over any day now. Herat is still known for its Persian culture, especially its miniature paintings and poetry. It's also a major city for the Sufi orders, especially the Naqshbandi. Western Afghanistan is an arid region blasted by hot air in the summer, which is known as the Wind of 120 Days, which sounds like something you don't want to experience. It is a mixed ethnic region of Uzbeks and Tajiks in the north and Durrani Pashtuns in the south. The Aimak, a nomadic Persian-speaking people, live in the mountains to the east of Herat. The vast majority of Herat's population, the city population, is Tajiks or Farsiwan, Persian-speaking Shia Muslims that are usually just classified with the Tajiks. Pashtuns are only a small minority in Herat. To the south of Herat is the Pashtun-majority city of Farah and the Shindand military base, which would become a major Soviet stronghold. The Harirud River fertilizes the Herat area, and Herat province is the second most populated in the country after Kabul province. Western Afghanistan's farms produce 90% of the country's saffron. Coming around to southern Afghanistan, its dominant city was originally founded by Alexander the Great as one of his many cities named after himself, so Alexandria. You know, Alexandria of Arachosia, and that was what the city was called. The guy didn't have an ego problem at all. The Pashto version of Alexander's name, Iskandar, gradually merged into the current name the city holds today, Kandahar. Kandahar is the largest majority Pashtun city in Afghanistan, the historic Pashtun center of power. At its heart is an Islamic shrine, the Kirka Sharif, or Shrine of the Cloak, which contains a garment supposedly belonging to the Prophet Muhammad himself. Ahmad Shah Durrani, founder of the modern Afghan kingdom, allegedly wore this cloak in 1747 when the Loya Jirga in Kandahar declared him as their king. Kandahar was Ahmad Shah's capital before his son Timur Shah moved it to Kabul. If you take the road southeast from Kandahar, you come to the city of Quetta in the Bolan Pass, one of the two major routes from Afghanistan into India. This is the route the British took when they invaded Afghanistan in 1839. They underestimated how difficult the route was, and lots of British soldiers and camp followers died of disease and heat exhaustion on the way into Afghanistan. These days, Quetta and the Bolan Pass are inside Pakistan's borders because of the Durand Line. Kandahar was also the site of the last battle of the Second Anglo-Afghan War in 1880, when Frederick Roberts defeated Ayub Khan's army outside the city walls. Southern Afghanistan is the Pashtun heartland, with two major tribal confederations dominating, the Durranis, west of Kandahar, and the Gilzais, east of Kandahar. The Durranis and Gilzais have struggled for control over Afghanistan for centuries. Kandahar dominates the Helmand Valley, a large fertile region full of small farmers. The Helmand is Afghanistan's most important river, and extensive irrigation networks help make it one of Afghanistan's probably its most fertile region. It's well known for its bountiful wheat harvest, as well as grapes and pomegranates, and more recently, opium. A very large number of veterans of the American war in Afghanistan served in Helmand Province, which was one of the strongholds of the Taliban. The population in southern Afghanistan is relatively small due to the surrounding deserts of Balochistan, Balochistan is a big region of southern Asia, split three ways between Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. The desert peoples are the Baloch, who are well known as smugglers due to their secret desert caravan routes. Moving on to eastern Afghanistan. You'll be starting to feel your ears pop as we head into the mountains. This is the very heavily elevated part of the country. Following the highway northeast from Kandahar, we pass by the city of Ghazni. Ghazni is one of the great old fortress cities of Afghanistan, a strategic strong point halfway between Kandahar and Kabul. One of the first great Afghan empire builders, Mahmud of Ghazni, ruled his empire from here in the early 1000s AD. Mahmud of Ghazni was basically just a big bandit king. He raided and looted India like on 15 separate expeditions. Finally, we arrive at the capital. Kabul is over three millennia old, sitting at the center of the Kabul River Valley, fringed by relatively fertile land and ringed by high mountains in every direction. It is one of the world's most elevated capital cities at 5,800 feet above sea level. Its summers are cool and its winters are very cold. The agriculture supports wheat, barley, grapes, fruit, and nut trees. Kabul is the true crossroads of Asia, sitting at the pivot point of Central Asia, Persia, and India, where all the mountain ranges and passes converge at this central hub. Kabul was the favorite city of Babur, the first Mughal emperor, who, even when he conquered India in the 1500s, still dreamed of the cool, fresh air and beautiful gardens of Kabul. Babur said,
11 or 12 tongues are spoken in Kabul. Arabic, Persian, Turkic, Mughalese, Hindi, Afghani, Pashai, Paraji, Gibri, Birki, and Lamgani. If there be another country with so many differing tribes and such a diversity of tongues, it is not known.
Kabul is by far the largest city in Afghanistan. Its population in the 1970s was probably 500,000. It's much more now. You'll see medieval-era mosques and fortresses sitting side-by-side with modern apartment buildings and gas stations. In the 1970s, before the wars began, Kabul was a dramatic mix of the ancient and modern, college students in jeans and sundresses riding bicycles next to traditional bazaars and donkeys loaded down with produce from the countryside. The bazaars were full of yelling shopkeepers where you could smell the spices of the world, and the call to prayer echoed throughout the city five times a day. Ethnically, Kabul was about half Tajik, a quarter Hazara, and a quarter Pashtun, give or take. We will, of course, see a lot of Kabul from beginning to end of this series. But eastern Afghanistan is more than just Kabul. This is a high, fractured area with all sorts of other interesting stuff around it. Like, there's all these mountain areas surrounding Kabul which all have their own things going on. We've done a big compass just now. We looked north, west, south, east around Afghanistan. Now we're going to do a little compass. We're going to look north, west, south, and east around Kabul. Let's go north first. 45 miles north of Kabul is Bagram, a major military base used by both the Soviets and the Americans. From there, the road splits in two. The northwestern fork takes us up a series of dangerous switchbacks, narrow roads along the side of cliffs, to the Salong Pass, one of the major passes across the Hindu Kush. Like all the other passes, it used to be closed 6 months out of the year. But in 1964, Soviet engineers built the Salong Highway Tunnel. The Salong Tunnel was the highest road tunnel in the world until 1973, when the United States built the Eisenhower Tunnel in Colorado. And it will be one of the most important places in Afghanistan in our story. It is absolutely vital for Soviet logistics, the narrow choke point where all military convoys have to pass on their way from the Soviet border to Kabul. Wonder what would happen if someone were to attack this narrow choke point. The other fork of the road to the northeast takes us to the source of many of those attacks, a narrow river valley called the Panjshir. surprisingly green, dotted up and down with villages, with the cold blue water of the Panshir flowing rapidly southward, overlooked by high mountains. Before the Salong Tunnel was built, the Panshir was one of the major passes through the Hindu Kush, running to the north, running southwest where it opens up into the Kabul Plain, up to the northeast, where narrow passes lead north to Tibet or south to India. The Panshir Valley is a Tajik-dominated area, where we will be spending a lot of time in this series. It became one of the major guerrilla strongholds of the Mujahideen. West of Kabul, the rough dirt road leads us into the high peaks of the Hindu Kush. This area in the middle of Afghanistan is the Hazarajat, the homeland of the Hazaras. The Hazarajat is rugged, difficult terrain, a maze of valleys and ridges and cliffs and some of the tallest mountains in the world. There are almost no roads suitable for motor vehicle traffic, making it very difficult to communicate and integrate this area with the outside world. I've heard stories from Americans who served in the Hazarajat area who would go up to a village and say hi, and they're like, "Hey, so are you Soviets?" Because they literally had no idea the Soviet-Afghan War had even ended a couple decades earlier. They are that remote. But there are still passes through the Hindu Kush, and these passes, like the Salong Pass, have carried travelers for millennia. One of these passes sits at Bamiyan, the largest city in Hazarajat, 110 miles west of Kabul and over 8,000 feet above sea level. In the late BC, early AD centuries, Buddhist missionaries carried their faith over these passes into Central Asia, China, Tibet, and eventually Japan and Korea. This was the gateway by which Buddhism spread to the rest of the world. This passage was symbolized by the Bamiyan Buddhas, massive Buddha statues carved into the mountains around Bamiyan, some of the largest Buddhas in the world. They were a World Heritage Site, one of the wonders of Afghanistan, until the Taliban destroyed them in 2000. South of Kabul, the road winds its way through Logar and Paktia provinces, through the city of Gardez, and across the high passes of the Suleiman Mountains. Now we reach the city of Khost, in the Suleiman Range close to the Afghan-Pakistani border. Khost is one of the main border crossings between these two countries. For most of the Soviet-Afghan War, Khost would be under siege, with its Soviet garrison cut off by the Mujahideen. The road through Logar and Paktia provinces became a constant battlefield, and the two provinces would suffer heavily in the fighting to come. East of Kabul, the Kabul River flows downward through the mountain passes that lead to India. Follow this valley. We're going to pass by the Khord Kabul Pass, where the Afghan guerrillas destroyed Elphinstone's army in the First Anglo-Afghan War. We're actually going downhill now, getting closer to sea level. The air is a little bit thicker and more humid. Down the Kabul River, below and to the east of Kabul, is the valley and city of Jalalabad. Again, remember, Afghanistan's terrain and climate are vertical as much as they are horizontal. Jalalabad is warm throughout the year, and its main crops include rice and citrus fruits. You can buy fresh oranges in the snow-covered streets of Kabul that were grown in warm Jalalabad just a few miles down the road. That is why Jalalabad contained the winter palace for kings governing from Kabul. It got too cold in Kabul. Well, let's just go down the road a couple miles to Jalalabad. Jalalabad is a heavily Pashtun city, the center of Nangarhar province, the fourth largest city in Afghanistan, and another hotbed of Afghan resistance during the Soviet occupation. Now the road splits again. If we follow it southeast, well, that's the way to the Khyber Pass, the gateway to India, the corridor for armies from Alexander the Great to Genghis Khan to Babur and Ahmad Shah Durrani. The British marched up this pass in their wars, and they came back down it feeling a lot worse. Now, before we get to the end of the Khyber Pass, we are going to hit the Pakistani border. On the other side of that border is the Pashtun city of Peshawar, which we'll talk about in a minute. To the northeast from Jalalabad, the road takes you into Afghanistan's real upcountry, the Pamir Shelf, the roof of the world. Mostly the provinces of Badakhshan and Nuristan and Kunar. The high mountainous northeast corner of Afghanistan contains some of the most remote mountain valleys in the world. The Kunar River flows into the Kabul River at Jalalabad, and the Kunar Valley, stretching up to the northeast, has been a headache for invaders since Alexander the Great. The Soviets will have a bad time in the Kunar Valley. The rivers that feed the Kunar spiderweb into a dizzying series of valleys and gorges and crevices, winding higher and higher and higher into Nuristan and Badakhshan, places most Afghans would regard as weird and distant upcountry. No invader has ever really conquered these places, mainly because it's just not worth it. Nuristan in particular was a tough nut for the Americans during their war in Afghanistan. Some of the nastiest fighting of that war took place up in these narrow, remote valleys. The Battle of Wanat in 2008, the famous Battle of Kop Keating, aka the Outpost, in 2009, the campaigns in the Korangal Valley at OP Restrepo. Medals of honor, many have been earned by Americans fighting in the distant valleys of the Roof of the World. So that is, for the most part, the Grand Tour. We looked at Afghanistan's four big regions: the north around Mazar-e-Sharif, the west around Herat, the south around Kandahar, and the east around Kabul. And we took a good look at some points of interest around Kabul, including Bagram, the Salong Pass, and the Panjshir Valley to the north, Bamiyan and the Hazar Jat to the west, Khost and the Pakistani border to the south and east, and Jalalabad and the Khyber Pass and the Kunar Valley to the east and northeast. But here's the thing. Again, part of Afghanistan is missing. This is the Phantom Limb, a land that probably should be part of Afghanistan but isn't. A fifth region that is missing. When the British drew the Durand Line with Afghanistan in the 1890s, a huge number of Pashtuns found themselves on the wrong side. This included the great city of Peshawar at the mouth of the Khyber Pass down the road from Jalalabad. For centuries, Peshawar was the gateway from Afghanistan to India. Invaders followed the road from Kabul to Jalalabad, through the Khyber Pass to Peshawar, and now you're in India. The Afghan Pashtuns have never been reconciled to the loss of Peshawar, or the huge Pashtun-dominated area that the British locked behind the borders of their empire, which is now the Pakistani border. In Pakistan, this province used to be called the Northwest Frontier Province, but was renamed the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa in 2010. The Afghan-India border, and later the Afghan-Pakistani border, would be an enormous headache for everyone on both sides well into the 20th century, as we've discussed. The Soviets, and later the Americans, found it impossible to control the flood of weapons and money and people, including armed insurgents and Islamic terrorists, across this border. Is there a reason I'm talking about the Durand Line so much? I don't know. Come back and tell me after the series is over if you think I spent too much time on this. All in all, Afghanistan is a beautiful, diverse country, ancient and modern, with rich history stretching back millennia and people who just wanted to be left alone. What has happened to it in the last 40 years is a crime that many countries have had a hand in perpetrating, including, in many cases, the Afghans themselves. In this descent into war and destruction, one of the great tragedies of the late 20th century, a tragedy that has rippled across hemispheres and sent planes into buildings and bombs into schools and missiles into weddings and thousands of soldiers and civilians into the grave, this descent began in 1979 when the Soviet Union launched a special military operation and initiated the Soviet-Afghan War. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, this prologue, this extended look at Afghanistan and its people and history. If you like what you've heard today, spread the word. Let people know that I'm back and we're about to go to the Graveyard of Empires again. If you want to know my sources or look at my very painstakingly designed maps for this series, they are on my website at unknownsoldierspodcast.com. If you want to contribute to my book fund, I have a donate button there as well. Easiest way to contact me is on the Facebook page or drop me a line at unknownsoldierspodcast@gmail.com. And guys, thanks for rejoining me once again. I'll see you in about a week to really get started on this story. In the Soviet-Afghan War Part 1, a special military operation. Only here on Unknown Soldiers.